This week's show, live from the ECC Future Leaders Wednesday session with Tanis Laviniak and Nathan Wood.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, Tanis, we're on a stage, we're live, we're in my beautiful home state of Colorado with the Broadmoor background here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is the first time I've done a live podcast, so this is going to be fantastic. We're normally sitting behind video cameras when we're recording, so it's a little bit different being on stage.
Yeah, we're a little zoomed in. At least your microphone's not in your way, so you can't hit it with your hands today.
I talk with my hands, so I'm constantly hitting the microphone. This is much better.
Yeah, no dogs to run in, no kids to run in. It's a good day. Nathan Wood, this is our home state, so we got Tanis outnumbered here.
It feels good to be home, but it does feel weird not having headphones on, but I'll get used to it.
Yeah, you can't hear me in your head telling you what to do, yeah, those kind of things. All right, we have to pause for the cause. Construction has one of the highest suicide rates of any industry. This needs to change. Visit getconstructiontalking.org or preventconstructionsuicide.com for more information. We need you to get involved. Remember, 988 from your mobile phone at any time for any urgent need. We're back on YouTube. That's right. Check us out at youtube.com/@TheConTech Crew. Like and smash that subscribe button. We need your subscriptions. Get our shorts.
Yeah, they can go ahead and laugh. I don't know if your kids do the smash that subscribe button, but that is all the rage these days.
All right. Well,
That
is all the pomp and circumstance of how you get into a podcast. So I'm glad to have you guys come along with us. It's kind of odd to look out over a show. So for everybody tuning in, we're actually live here. So we have a whole large audience here. We're going to be talking about some of these key components that we went ahead and surveyed the group ahead of time. So we're going to start focusing. And remember, we're construction technology. And it's great to see that we came into this event a little bit after, you know, a group of folks that were actually running projects and talking about the process and talking about the contracts and those kinds of things. We're here to talk about making the rubber hit the road with technology and efficiencies. So first and foremost, project collaboration and communication. That's not a small topic. So I'm going to kick it to you, Tanis, here to sort of talk a little bit about what that means to you in a project collaboration and communication.
That's a big topic to unpack. So I'll do my best in the short time period that we have. I mean, we've been executing projects in the construction industry for, centuries, longer than that. We've always communicated, but the means and methods that we've used to communicate with each other have ultimately changed. Through the use of technology and through improved processes where people are more able to connect with each other. Projects are global, we've got teams all over the place, so we have to find ways to get people together, sharing the right information at the right time. 13% of a construction professional's day is spent looking for the data that they need to do their jobs. So even though we have all this technology out there that teams are deploying and using and getting really excited about, we still have people spending a lot of time searching for information. So communication is not as good as it should be. And I think everybody in the room can probably attest to that. At some point, you went running left when you should have gone right because you didn't have the right information. As projects get bigger, they become more global. This gets harder and harder. So, and this is not just a technology challenge, it's a process challenge. It really comes down to how we create an open and transparent culture on projects and get people communicating authentically. I heard authentic introductions earlier in discussion. I mean, authenticity is key to this. But it's also about creating an environment where people feel safe to share their thoughts, their ideas, their concerns. And that can be hard sometimes. Construction is fast-paced. We move quickly. It can be a little bit rah-rah, and, you know, we don't have time for that. We have to go. We've got things to do. Better communication means getting everybody involved, including those small voices that are sitting at the table.
Yeah, it's I saw an Adam Grant recently that was like, it's not the loudest person at the table that you need to always listen to, that there's actually some of the most quiet voices. resources that need to be brought out. And I think that's the cool part about modern technology and modern technology tools, is that we can kind of cultivate and look for that. We can provide, just like we're providing here on stage today, different ways for folks to ask us questions and engage, because you've got to be able to draw those things out. And I'm going to, you know, promote a good friend of mine here, because I thought it was interesting that we did it as a collaboration and communication, because DJ Phipps, a longtime guest and friend from Procore, said, communication is contractual, collaboration is cultural. There is a very distinct difference between how you do the two. And so, Nathan, I'm kind of interested, since you kind of get to look at our AEC world, but you've also seen the change in communication on a project level for a long time, what that means to you to be culture versus just communicating.
Well, I mean, I think one of the comments earlier in the panel was, you know, break them down before you build them up. And I think there's so much to answer your point about culture, and that technology isn't just going to fix bad process. Technology isn't going to fix bad culture. You have to start with the people, fix that culture that then develops the right process that then leads to the right technology choices. And so as we see, you know, some of these responses coming through here of how many different platforms you guys are using, you know, as I see, you know, a lot of folks in that 2 to 3, 4 to 9, 10 plus range of platforms, you have to ask that question of, why are we using so many different technology platforms that are supposed to be making our lives easier, but all we really end up doing is adding multiple systems together, or basically doing duplicate entry in different systems, right? This gray work you've talked about.
Yeah, the idea of gray work, a good friend of mine at QuickBase came up with this idea for gray work, is all the work that you do that does not provide value. It's that looking for data time. It's that connecting different systems. It's all those Excel spreadsheets. It's all those little plans in the drawer, those little places that you do things, whether you keep it in your notes or you're a OneNote person. So for the listeners at home, we have a little poll going on that's just talking about how many different systems you use to collaborate at one given time. And of course, it shouldn't be a surprise that the majority are using 4 to 9 or 10 plus systems to communicate. Tanis, I'm kind of interested, like, can anybody really do that?
Well, I'm glad to see that nobody said zero, so win. But I mean, realistically, if you're using that many different applications, no, you can't. I mean, people are going to be drawn to specific applications depending on the type of work that they do. But I mean, checking notifications in 10 different applications and trying to communicate with different teams, with different apps, it's incredibly difficult. And as you end up with large projects with lots of different stakeholders and everybody has their own technology ecosystems, trying to integrate that can be extremely difficult. And, you know, I feel for owners on projects who also have to navigate all of that plus their internal systems and transfer data back and forth. So this is a very real challenge that project teams have to navigate, but not having a central project ecosystem necessitates all these different applications and platforms that people are using. And realistically, I mean, are we collaborating through that many applications? No.
No, and that's the thing is too, there's a couple of different mental states and things that people need to kind of understand right now. Is like, one of the best things you can do, especially those that work in, you know, engineering and are working in drawings or in drawing themselves and need to get into a flow state to go, all of those alerts, all those dings, all those things, they pull you out of your flow state and you can't get in and get productive. And it's the numbers that we've seen in studies across, and by the way, not just our world, you know, of EPC construction or the AEC space in general, it's pretty much across all businesses, is that technology, if it's not thought through with the level of what I call digital empathy, right? If you don't understand what it takes to work in your project team, and you know, we heard this from the earlier group, you have to have alignment and a good culture together. Well, part of that alignment is on the tools and technology and on the way we're going to engage and on the way that we're going to interrupt one another. So if you are on those projects, part of what you need to think of with that alignment is, what are the tools I'm requiring somebody to fill out consistently across their day to get their job done? Because if I'm asking them to do RFIs or PCOs in 4 different places each time they need to do it, and I need to then send an email to tell somebody to check the Excel log, that's a bad process. That is not empathetic. You are having them work and not be valuable. And we'll get to later on, you know, we have a labor shortage. Let's just be honest. And we're not going to fix that, right? Like, that's just not going to go away. If it was going to go away, somebody would have come up here and told you how it's going to go away and be gone. It's just not going to. But we're going to have to get better through these tools. And this is where Nathan, you know, we talk a lot at the CPC and we work consistently on workshops to help with this alignment, with this digital empathy. So talk a little bit about how project teams can go through that process.
Yeah, and I think I'm very curious in this room, and please, you know, again, bring stories, bring questions, because I often feel kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, or this analogy to like Stretch Armstrong, because you may have corporate policies or corporate IT requirements, but then you've got projects and clients, and they want you to use their system, and it's sort of this always this back and forth, and you end up in an Excel spreadsheet because it's just kind of that lowest common denominator, but it's not fixing this system of we know we need data, we know we need analytics, we know we need to see how we're doing and do all this measurement stuff. So I just think a lot of this burnout that a lot of us, at least as technologists or even just those that are kind of in the office and field roles, are very frustrated right now. And I think technology, it can solve it, but I think industry has a big role in how we're going to find that single source of truth, this elusive central place where everything's supposed to go, because nobody seemed to really figure it out yet in any industry.
Yeah, and it really hasn't been. And Tanis, I'm kind of interested in kind of your thoughts on all of those systems and aligning teams, because you have had success over the years with it.
Absolutely. Anybody who follows me on LinkedIn knows that I often rant about Excel spreadsheets. It's just one of my pain points, but it is the lowest common denominator. And a lot of times data is transferred through Excel spreadsheets. People maintain them. They feel comfortable with Excel. It's you know, an emotional attachment sometimes. But transferring data becomes incredibly challenging. Things get lost. People don't trust what's in the spreadsheet. And, you know, where do you go from there? So 30% of the data that's created on a project from engineering and construction is lost by the time the project closes out, 30%. Now, every piece of information we create has a cost. There's time that goes into that. There's governance, there's curation, there's movement. 30% of it just evaporates by the time the project ends. Some of that, it's okay. I don't care who was responsible for coming up with the, you know, project t-shirt logo at the end of the project. That's not information I need at closeout. So some of that will disappear naturally. But some of it is what we call dark data. It lives on people's desktops. It's not being shared freely. And that's not because people don't want to collaborate. It's because they don't have the ability to. And that's through both process and technology. So having a common data environment within a project, I mean, is it difficult? It absolutely is. It requires you to move away from systems you're comfortable with, hopefully away from Excel, into an environment that the project is using to deliver a successful outcome. And that requires everybody jumping on board. And that's not always easy, right? People have their own systems internally. But if you can do that, and I've experienced projects where we've done that, we spent a lot of time setting up those common ecosystems and integration so everybody had the information they needed at the right place at the right time. If you invest in that early in the project, you can communicate and collaborate much more effectively. And that 30% data evaporation starts to decrease.
Well, and you're like, the 30% is this hard number of things that you're losing right there. You're losing time. You also have dark data. You're paying for it. But what I think this group needs to understand as leaders moving into the future is these are also your KPIs, your guideposts, your information, your data. And if it's dark, if it's in gray work, if it's in Excel spreadsheets and it's not consumed, it can do not just harm. I mean, it can be not just bad, it can do harm to your organization. Because if you then take the analytics that you have and you're missing all of this information and you make critical business decisions based on missing information, you can really steer your ship in the wrong direction. So it's also part of understanding the empathy. And I heard this earlier and I thought this was great. The earlier group said the client is construction. Understanding and having empathy for the way the field has to work and where you have to interact. Yes, your Excel spreadsheet might be great for everybody in the office, but think about the person that's out in the field doing the work that needs to add their pieces to it. You are really putting them in a severely difficult situation, and you're probably at best going to get as little as they can give you. And what you really want is a rich set of data that will help you out. Well, I love this. Barry, you got a question in the back.
Yeah, no, thanks, Jeff. Tennis, what new tech have you seen to be the most impactful and widely adopted to date?
Oh, that's a good one. I know everybody wants me to say AI. It's not AI. So we'll just throw that on the table right now.
Blockchain?
I mean, not blockchain either. No, the whole cryptocurrency thing. I mean, people just, yeah, it's become a blocker. But most impactful, to Jeff's point, I think are really the technologies that are deployed at the work face. Getting information to frontline teams. So that's frontline supervisors and the crews that are actually doing the work in a way that's timely and easily accessible, I think makes all the difference in the world. And it doesn't, that's not the exciting stuff. It's not drones, it's not robots.
But there is a buzzword though now, field of financials.
There
because
is,
because again,
yeah.
Like how do you make it super easy? How do you create a frictionless experience for those that are out in the field doing the work to
yes.
capture what they got done, have that daily report automated, have that timesheet automated so that you can get to that higher level financial reporting without having to go through a bunch of gray work and dark data and all this mess. And so yeah, like really connecting that together, but means starting from square one, rethinking the objective, and reworking that whole process through technology.
Exactly, and making it accessible, right? You don't want your frontline supervisors having to go back to a trailer to look something up, right? They're at the work face, their job is to supervise their crews, give them the information they need when they need it. I can't tell you how many frontline supervisors I've talked to through my career that have never had a tablet, they don't have a laptop, they don't have access to those types of devices. They're reliant on other people to print out information for them so they can go out into the field. Mobile devices are when it comes to actually impacting the day-to-day work in construction, tablets are what's changed the game, ultimately. I mean, you've got extensions from that and some of the chatbot applications and project management tools to collect data. I think all of those are extremely impactful, but really just digitalizing and getting technology out to the workface is key because there's still a lot of sites, but that doesn't happen.
Yeah, from my perspective, I'd say that we have a pretty good hold on project management solutions as a whole, as a center for what we're doing. The problem is they're not as well connected to the other individual tools that we need. We could have a whole talk about how that is, it's really impossible to have one ring to rule them all. It's not going to happen. So we do need this idea of a connected ecosystem that can work together. And I was working with a person on a project recently on a mega project in Ohio that they actually spent tens of thousands of dollars up front as a group to integrate and create connections between their different systems and then ran the KPIs on how much it saved them, how much data they were able to collect. And I think for me, that's some of the really quiet, really good, it's like daily reports, it's that field of financials, it's those kinds of things that are really pushing and moving the needle forward. So it was great. Barry, it looks like we got another one.
Yeah. No, we got another one for the whole group here. Implementing new tools to fix the communication and collaboration issues can be costly and difficult. What quick wins are there for this challenge that you've seen in the interim? Communication plans, training, better kickoff meetings, to name a few suggestions.
All right, I can take that one. Because I think, again, regardless of EPC, CM, how you're set up, you're going to have multiple different parties that want access to the same information. And too often, each party buys their own system and then thinks that they should connect together. When really, more often than not, it's better to just have a conversation early, decide which company you're gonna start with and kind of collaborate there, and then let that information share back into your system sort of after the fact. I think there are, again, ways of rethinking the process to get rid of that redundancy, but that would be my recommendation.
Yeah, and I would actually say that it goes all the way back to the beginning of the charter, just like the contract. When you're aligning on means and methods, you're aligning on how you're going to deliver, you're aligning on your contract language. Technology has to be a part of that conversation. How you are going to digitally communicate and creating the rule sets, the process, right? It's always people, process, then technology. Any other way is just a really fast way to fail. So you've got to align there and take the time, but also the group has to realize why. It always goes back to why. Why do we need this? Why is this going to impact the field? The field needs to understand why filling out this form is not just accounting, getting them to do their jobs for them. Why filling out a daily log isn't just about pencil whipping and getting to understand that the boss knows they did what they were supposed to do today. That these actually, you know, daily reports can actually get us paid, which gets us paid faster, which keeps the job moving. It can also kick off material purchasing, other things like that. So I want to move us into, because what we're really talking about is efficiently and effectively using our labor. And we have a labor shortage and workforce challenges, and that is not just in the field. We have that when it comes to knowledge work as well. So I really wanted to kind of look at Nathan and say, you know, when you think about labor, we talk about labor shortages, we talk about workforce challenges. What are some of the topics that, you know, you're hearing in Construction Progress and across the industry right now?
I mean, I think the biggest conversation is the balance between are we recruiting or are we retaining? Because I think what we're seeing, and again, it could be a lot of our own bias of who we're looking at and who we're working with, but we're seeing a lot of really talented folks leaving the industry to work in other industries because they just frankly don't feel satisfied in this industry. And it's a very frustrating state for folks to be at. And maybe that's more of just a technologist thing where they kind of don't feel like they find a space. But I think there's a struggle there where you've got a lot of holes that you can't recruit or retain because there's almost a toxic nature to it. And then the craft side that has always been and will continue to be a challenge that is, again, this awakening that all these years of saying you have to go to college, you shouldn't go straight into the trades, that, you know, Tannis and I grew up with, and we're told, at least I was told that, I don't know. But
so was I.
Okay, I was just making sure. I mean, I don't want to lump us together, but at any rate, I think those are the stigmas that we have to kind of unlearn when we talk about, you know, again, that change that we really need to do. It's how we see the world and how that changes our behaviors moving forward.
Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@thecontechcrew.com to learn more. Yeah, I'm interested, Tannis, because he hit on a couple of different things on the, you know, the trades and the crafts, which I think is really going to be consistently one of our biggest problems. So how can these future leaders and how can anybody listening kind of think about bridging that gap? You can't solve it, but you can improve it. So what are some of the ways we can improve it?
Absolutely. So we talk about this a lot on the show. What was the last number? 550,000 open positions in the industry that need to be filled right now. That's a lot. And to Jeff's point, that's not something we're just going to fix overnight.
And that's before some of the new bills came out with
Absolutely.
More stuff. So we were
yes.
over 500,000 plus behind before then.
This is a challenge that affects everyone. And when you look at the project-based nature of our work, and sometimes the very remote nature of our work, being in industrial space, it's even more difficult. Because if you're recruiting a welder, that welder may very well have a family. He or she wants to be close to town, doesn't want to necessarily travel an hour to site and back each day. Working a 12-hour shift, the structure of how we execute projects in some cases is keeping people away from pursuing a career in construction, industrial construction specifically. I started my career on site. 4 a.m. mornings were common. You were on site at 5:30, you started work at 6, you got off at 5:30, you went back to camp and, you know, ate and showered and got up the next morning and did the same thing. That's not for everybody. And there are definitely people out in the industry that are considering careers in construction that don't want to do that. But that structure is not set in stone. We don't have to follow that type of structure. So if you think about students, if you think about parents, if we provided within the construction industry more flexible work options, whether that's in the trades or in technical roles, we could recruit more people. There's people that could work in the morning and go to school in the afternoon, or they have childcare commitments, so they can't start on site at 6 a.m., but they'd love to work a, you know, 10 to 3 o'clock shift. There are lots of people out there in the industry that we can recruit, but we are preventing that in a lot of cases purely by the work hours that we're setting on our project sites. That's got to change.
Yeah, and again, we're going to go back to some of the things I heard earlier in the day is anticipation of needs, looking at means and methods, and ultimately business development. Part of this process and sitting in it is you have to be not only the place that your owners want to come and do the work and partner with you, but also that the trades want to do that. That you have to think about that. And we have to change the way we build even in this type of construction, we have to start looking at building offsite more. Why? Because of those same reasons, those same people can get up and happily, I just talked to a factory, a group that's doing offsite fabrication at a massive scale, and one of the greatest things they've been able to do is recruit working mothers because they have childcare on site, and these folks and these women can show up early, and actually men can show up early that are in charge of their children and drop them off, work a full shift, be productive, and leave. And it also reduces the number of people that need to be on site and need to be installing. But the key to that is if we don't do it at the earliest phase and we don't predict those needs while we're designing and engineering, we're never going to get there. Right, we keep doing the same thing over and over and wondering why it doesn't work. Definition of insanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And practice, by the way.
But I think you're hitting on the point that it's just because there's a big gap in engineering design and field craft and labor staff doesn't necessarily mean we need to recruit more, or doesn't necessarily mean we need to recruit more there. It could just mean we need more automation or more AI. This fear that AI is going to take our jobs, like, well, but if we need more jobs, then is that a bad thing? I think we have to ask that question, right?
If we think about that 13% of a day that people are spending looking for information, if we can decrease that, ultimately, we can decrease the number of people we need on projects. If we can make people more efficient, absolutely. And, you know, ultimately, just flipping back to work structure, if you look at the turnover rate in the industry, it's, I think, 21% was the last stat I saw. That's high compared to other industries. It's 64% for those under 24. So when you think about the project-based nature of our work, also start thinking about how you can maintain a steady workforce in a portfolio-based structure. Because if you can recruit skilled trades, recruit engineers, technicians, and keep them employed project to project to project instead of going through those ebbs and flows, construction will be a much more attractive industry to those who are younger and are seeing this 64% turnover rate. I mean, you're thinking about starting a family, you're thinking about career development. If you don't know where your next job is going to be in 2 months, does construction look very attractive? Maybe not.
No, and that stability is really, really important, especially for young as we bring them into the industry. But it's also something, and I'm going to challenge the leaders in the room and the listeners at home to think about for a second. Like, there's a lot of folks that stomp around the office and complain about these young kids leaving and not staying. And if you have that consistently, you might be the problem. It's just part of it. So as the future of the leadership in this industry, you need to see that. You need to absorb that. But I'm not here to beat you over the head with it and make you think you're a bad person for it, a bad company for it. There is plenty of companies in this industry and others that are struggling with all of this technology because there is a shiny toy no matter what hallway you go down, at what show you're at, and every time you turn around. It's not easy. That is why we preach the empathy, we preach listening, and we preach leaning in. Ask those people why they're leaving. Think about maybe it is us. What can we do better? I was working with a recruiter. I was talking to somebody earlier about pre-construction. And I was working with a pre-construction recruiter, and it's amazing that the first question that most of the candidates now ask, because by the way, you cannot get those folks either right now, just across the industry, like really good pre-construction folks are hard and they're making up their own numbers to go where they want. The first question they're asking, what does your tech stack look like? Raise of hands in here and I'll tell the folks at home, how many of you even understand what the idea of a tech stack is? Or have heard that term before. Okay. So for those at home, we got about two or three and we're in a room of 100 or so, maybe more. I didn't know the numbers.
300 at least. Come on, Jeff.
300 at least. There's 1,000 people in here. Shh, don't tell anybody at home. There's 1,000 people in here. A technology stack is exactly what I was talking to you about earlier with the digital empathy. It's your project management system. It's your accounting system. It's your reality capture system. It's your BIM and scanning systems. It's all of those different things. It's everything down to, yes, you use Excel or you use Google. You use these things. These are your technology stack. It's what you use in pre-construction, whether you're using some sort of, you know, takeoff tools or estimating tools or whatever you're using, that is your stack. And you have to understand it and be able to articulate it, not only to recruit, but we also know this since we have business development in here, that's going to be very valuable to your owners. Owners, you should be asking that question because ultimately it's about the experience you're going to get through the tools. Can I see into what's going on my job site? Am I confident? How many times am I having to ask for the same bit of information? What do I not trust the information that's coming in? So see, these are some of the things too that when you ask multiple times, you end up creating doubt and rework. And digital rework is just as costly as physical rework. And I think we need to understand that. So if we have people entering things into multiple systems, they are digitally reworking. So any final thoughts on it? Before I move
on. You beautifully articulated the fact that, yeah, as a company, you need your stack. And as we get into a project, again, we were talking about project interoperability and having something in the center. If you're an owner that says, I want to build my own stack, but then you want to work with a bunch of EPCs or CMs that have their own stack, it's going to be tougher to get those to mesh together. It might be better to just go with the contractor system. But again, those are discussions that happen in the beginning that go into a digital project execution plan, or again, whatever you want to call that addendum to your contract, that are these conversations that are not being had today that as future leaders, you know, you should be asking for and really driving for.
And I think where possible, be flexible. When you're going into a strategy session at the beginning of a project, you get everybody together. Everybody's got their own ways of working, and that's great.
Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built.
But as you're navigating what the project is going to look like to all the different stakeholders, sit back, listen, be flexible, be open to looking at new processes, new systems. You know, ultimately, it really comes down to getting the team on the same page. And if you can do that early on and you get people working together, things are going to be much more seamless down the road. And that is, I'm specifically referring to reporting requirements as a great example, right? You can have a great tech stack, lots of very good technology that automates the production of reports, but then you get the, oh yeah, but we need these 56 other ones. Well, that's when the Excel spreadsheets start coming into play. So there's some things that are nice-to-haves, there's some things that are need-to-haves. Those are topics that the team really should get aligned on at the beginning of the project and figure out what that looks like so you can eliminate those manual Excel data entry,
What you're hitting on there is the point of exchange, right?
Exactly.
That there is going to be a document that is exchanged between different systems at different points of time, because we still sign contracts, we still need to have that transactional record of what happened, but it doesn't have to be an Excel, it doesn't even have to be a PDF, it could be an API, not to use a tech term, but yeah, like this whole world of, does your system have an open API? Is this opening the gates to having these conversations that get away from Excel?
And to go back to the earlier question we had about, you know, what technology, what tools, what things we see getting the most adoption, I'll go back to, they are the ones that work. And what's interesting is most people go into their discussion of alignment and tech stack, et cetera, kind of like we do in contracts, right? We go in and we try to fight our way out and win. What I want you to understand when you go in there is you're not going in there to win. You're going in there to understand how your systems work, have a firmly held belief on what works for you, but to also sit across from everybody there and hear new ideas. I say this all the time. You don't go to an escape room by yourself. You go with a group of people who provide a diversity of experience and a diversity of thought, so that you come out with a thing that is completely different than you went in. So go in with a good value and understanding your idea, but don't hold on to it like I either have to win or lose. Because if you go in that way, you actually just lose. Because basically you're either bending yourself or you're making someone else bend, and that never works. So this is one I really wanted to kind of get us into the next topic here, because contracting strategy and risk allocation. So this is an interesting one for us here, because again, Nathan and I come from more of the AEC space. So it's interesting as we got through this and started, you know, polling and talking to folks that this is a little different. So I'm going to turn it over to kind of the expert here.
Oh no. Oh no.
On contracting strategy and risk allocation, to Tanis.
This is a topic that people get pretty passionate about, and certainly a topic that came up even in the panel this morning. I enjoyed that discussion. A lot of teams in our industry treat risk like a hot potato. You don't want it, so you toss it to the next person, and hopefully they'll hold on to it for a while. That doesn't work. We all know that doesn't work. When we approach a situation with in order for me to win, you need to lose type scenario, nobody wins. It's game theory, right? So we've started to see the evolution of topics like collaborative contracting, getting away from, you know, lump sum, fixed fee, unit rate, time and materials, towards an integrated environment where everybody has skin in the game and you either all win or all lose together. Certainly it's been adopted and deployed more in the commercial space. In the industrial space, there's I2PD, if you're not familiar with that. Google it. It's Industrial Integrated Project Delivery, because we need another acronym. So it's not IPD, it's I2PD. But I think there's a lot of potential in contracting solutions like that, getting away from the traditional models, again, you know, being open to exploring new things, and putting everybody in an environment where you either all win or you all lose together.
Yeah, I like this, because we see this consistently. And this is somewhere where I will say that I think you're going to see a lot of value provided by custom-built AI that actually can help us with contract negotiations. Because ultimately, the one thing people love to go back to is like, oh, this is the contracts of the contracts. The contracts are the foundation of showing us how we are going to act as a group together. Right? We have a set of rules. It's like going into a game and not having any rules. We've got to have a set of rules, because we are multiple entities that have multiple, like, we have our own stake. If you're a crafts contractor, it's about your business. If you're an owner, it's about your business. If you're, you know, doing the engineering, it's about your business. So we all have those, and we have to be conscious of those biases. But contractually, we can set ourselves up with language that then allows us to freely move about the ecosystem and operate in a way that's collaborative. And we just don't give it enough credit. But I also believe that's because we spend an exorbitant amount of time on lawyers, and lawyers really like to get their money. And it's actually really getting good. And we saw the guys with ChatGPT up earlier. If you haven't used any of the tools that exist out there today to look at contracts and look for things, we can do this really fast now. And we can sit, and also it can be democratized so that we know across the industry itself what contracts are driving better outcomes. And that's some of the KPIs and things we need with these kinds of tools. Nathan?
But I think the point was made in the panel this morning by the owner's perspective that on their vision wheel, the risk needs to be fit for purpose, and that we can have different hybrid contracting models where certain scopes might be lump sum, other scopes might be cost reimbursable, and that the answer is it depends. And it's going back to have that conversation earlier, talk about the risk, don't shield yourself from it, don't play games with it, let's put it out there and put it with the most appropriate person. So I think that's just a really great strategy of just don't not talk about it, don't put it in the corner, let's talk about it, manage the risk, because there is no such thing as construction without risk. It's just that idea of making it fit for purpose, I like that.
Yeah, and just taking the technology spin on that, when you're looking at a project contract, I mean, if you've seen one, it's a behemoth, right? To navigate through that. But you have teams that have to go and execute on that contract once everybody signs it. Not everybody's a lawyer. Not everyone knows how to read legal language. So accessibility of that information is quite critical. And there are companies out there, tech companies out there, who are leveraging AI, which everybody's very excited about. I'm very excited about. To make that language more accessible, put it in plain English so that your construction teams, your engineering teams, your procurement teams can read it, understand it, and execute upon it. And ultimately, all be able to find information that they're looking for, have those risks highlighted for them.
Well, and this is what I'm really excited about when it comes to AI, because I'm on the fence of AI, right? I'm the one who says, I think in a lot of cases, we're still at the peak of inflated expectations.
Yeah,
I'm
an eye roller.
We're about to fall into the trough of disillusionment. If y'all don't know that curve, we can go over that curve at some point. But it just depends on which technology and where you are and how it's being applied. But there is, we talked earliest about, you know, project management and how many collaboration systems you're in and how you're doing that. This is where good wrappers around AI technology can raise questions, bring us things and actions at the time. So taking a contract that I could never read, and a lot of our field and craftspeople can't, right? Nor should they. It's not what we hired them to do. We want them to build, right? But if the AI can consume it, they can be in an application that they're using consistently, their main point, whatever their field level application on that iPad is, and they run into a weather delay, a potential change order, and they push in the button that says, hey, I've run into this. What if that system could consume the contract, propose, hey, the contract says you've got to let the owner know in writing by this much, and oh, by the way, every time you do it, it looks something like this. Edit the details, put in the pictures you need, and hit send. So something that used to take a lot of time and used to go back to the job trailer to get done, now it's done in 3 clicks. And ultimately, the software is not deciding. It's presenting the contractual options for a skilled professional to make the decision. And that's the power of AI and automation of these contracts. So that's why I threw change management up too, because I think this plays into what we're going to talk about when it comes to change management and how you define it. But before we do that, we got a question in the back. Barry.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. So I'm going to combine a couple of here. So what thoughts do you have on how a contractor can pivot when they go from a project with owner A to a project with owner B, when A and B use different technologies? This ties into how the tech stack will benefit them later, but can be a really high cost up front, and how do the licensing fees work across the organizations? And then the last piece here is just how do you tie integration into that? So focusing on how you get data flow between those systems. So it's kind of an all-encompassing question there.
All right. Any of you want that one first?
Just rewind this podcast back, you know, the last 30 minutes. But no, that, you know, specifically, Ed.
So when you're looking at corporate technology strategy, you really need to be looking at something that's flexible and adaptable to different projects. Because it, without question, as you're working with different clients, they're going to have different requirements. And if you've created an ecosystem that's either custom built and very closed off, or you're working with a tech provider that doesn't really take an open, integrated strategy approach to development, you're going to end up in a situation where those integrations become very difficult, if not impossible. So as you're evaluating your technology strategy as an organization, that's an ongoing process that doesn't just happen once. But as you're adding applications, you're platforming, you're replatforming, you're looking at your data structure and governance, really make sure that you are building something that is adaptable and can be easily integrated with other systems, because if you don't do that, you can't pivot from project A to project B. It's going to be a lot of work. Your IT team is not going to like you very much. And it just creates a lot of extra frustration that's definitely not needed. You can strategically build something that can allow you to pivot.
So I'm going to make up a new term here, dynamic SOPs, because I think, Jeff, you were kind of describing that before the question of this, what is this choose your own adventure that says we as a company need to retain this certain information, but how we go about doing that could be path A, could be path B, could be path C, depending on if we're an owner that enforces eBuilder or some other, you know, system requirement, and there's all different situations that you could come into. So there is no, you know, Barry, to your question, there is no easy answer to that, because that's why we're in construction. The answer is it depends on your project, but having an approach that says not just here's our way of doing it and put it up against the wall and then you bat it all together and come up with some hodgepodge, you know, execution plan that nobody follows. Like, why not start with something that's more of a question-based, where you guys go through it together and make those decisions of whose system should it start in, where should it end, and what's the pathway to get there?
Yeah, and I'm going to take this because I've actually been on the tech stack building side, but I've also been on the software sales side and software creation side for the lifetime of my career. So I kind of bridge both gaps. And two parts of that question that are interesting to me is one about the question of licensing and licensing fees and the costs of this upfront. restaurant. People are expensive too. So most of the time when you don't do it with the systems, you're doing with a person, and a person cannot work at the speed that a computer can. And computers don't take days off. Computers don't need healthcare. They don't need those things. And so overall, when you're doing a total cost, you've got to look at those things. I don't believe in return on investment. I believe in return on implementation and what it value it can bring. However, I also do believe that licensing fees, especially in our current world, are getting way out of hand. And it's because we don't look at them from a consumption base and what they're actually providing us to. And I think that's also where you guys as leaders can sit down and understand that those fees are negotiable. And you can tell I don't work for a software company right now because I can say that. So they are negotiable. And you should sit down and talk about your consumption rates. There is a difference between generating a bunch of reports, 57 different reports that we need to deliver to somebody, and I am in the system taxing it, using it, benefiting from it. Those are two very different use cases, and it's something that we need to mature. The construction technology ecosystem, which includes all of us, the AECO and the EPC world, is not mature yet. It is maturing and it is getting there fast, but it's not bringing you all along with us. And we need that there because they need to make money because they're in business, and you need to make money because you're in business. That's the other little secret here, by the way, is everybody's actually doing this to make money and be profitable. We're just a little scared to say it for some reason. So looks like we've got one in the back, and then I'm going to jump us to the last one. So what do we got, Barry?
Can the hand of government be waved to regulate harmonization of technology applications in some form of technology standards?
Oh, no.
The standards discussion.
Somebody always asks about standards every time. So who's going to mandate the standards? I missed one of the words
the
in
government.
The middle there.
Can
the role of government.
The role of government play in creating sort of the technology standard?
If you're working in the DOT world, I mean, yeah, I think we're seeing some steps and strides towards some level of data standardization or leveraging the 3D model as a legal deliverable. I mean, you're seeing some. I mean, but like my answer, I'm leaning towards no. Like, I want to say yes, but I'm leaning towards no.
My answer is going to be no. Actually, to be honest, my answer is going to be no. Unfortunately, and this is going to be unpopular thing is, but that the standards in our world have been used to make money. And they're privatized and they're withheld and they're not easy to access and they do not benefit us as an industry. They just are used as a stick instead of a carrot. When ultimately I think this is the opportunity, and this is a great segue to ask y'all to get out there and talk to, we don't have an enterprise data set for construction and EPC. And what do I mean by that? It means we have this when it comes to the Genome Project. We have this when it comes to the FCC. In all of these other areas, they've opened it up so that you can access the information. You can access and create an enterprise data. We need someone in academia that has no dog in the fight to do this with us so that we can actually change the way we're viewed, reported, and measured. And we just don't have it. And you can see that in things like McKinsey reports and other things that come out about us. That's their data, and it's all lumped together. And they're lumping you with commercial construction and with individual home construction. That is not a view of our world. We need a good view of our world. We need good data. We need good data standards, which, by the way, will then turn around and allow integrations and other things to work really, really well. So that's just my little soapbox.
But I will say standards have been built and have not been enforced. So it's a yes and. Yes, you need to build them. And the enforcement mechanism, again, should or should it not be government? I don't know.
Honestly, this is where I come into. This is where I come into. Capitalism should be that enforcer. So you as an owner, you as an engineer, you as a trades craftsperson, you as a supplier, you choose with your dollars and your selection of your partners that those are enforced. So you just choose the partners who do it, and the ones who don't, and they lose a job, that's when they come back on board, right?
So I'm going to disagree with you guys a little bit. I like to be the troublemaker. And not saying I endorse this strategy, but looking at what was done in the United Kingdom with the BIM standards back in like 2011, that's a good example of government mandate. So if you wanted to work on a publicly funded project in the United Kingdom, you had to demonstrate that you met a certain level of BIM ability, if that's a term. If it's not, we've just made it up. Or you were not eligible to bid on projects. And if you bid on projects and you kind of fudged your way through it and tried to figure it out and couldn't demonstrate it, you ended up in a pretty bad spot. So that requirement took the bar from, you know, where it was and elevated it. And that was uncomfortable for a lot of organizations and a lot of teams, but they upped their game. They learned what BIM was if they didn't know. They got their teams up to speed, and they started, you know, for the most part, meeting those requirements. What we saw from there is a bit of a filtration into the private sector. So I'm not saying government mandates are the way to do it, but in the past, it has provided some value in having a government mandate for BIM in the UK.
Impact, yes. Value, I don't know. I know enough people in the UK that by the time that design that was very strict requirement made its way to construction, which was where the ultimate value should have been unveiled, I think it didn't necessarily pan out as well.
But I think it pushed a lot of boundaries in terms of tech use and adoption.
Agreed.
From an education perspective, perhaps created value.
I think it's a yes and. And it opened up opportunities for forward-thinking contractors, forward-thinking designers to try to get and reach this goal and reach this carrot that has been created. Because again, that was it, ISO
19360,
right?
Oh man,
it's ISO 19360.
It used to be PAS 1192. Now it's 19650.
And it actually drove a lot of innovation. It drove a lot of people pushing. Did it achieve its ultimate goal? No, I don't think it did. I think if we had other measurables in the background around our data and the way we do things, then we would have that. But this is why we do podcasts, right? Because we're not actually here to agree. We don't always agree. In fact, some of our best discussions are when we disagree.
And actually, and I'll go to the point of media, because Boeing is a great example of like pass, or it's ISO 9001 or whatever, like the manufacturing one that everybody, and they'd passed all those things because they checked the box and did whatever they're supposed to do. As soon as they start coming back and rechecking, it was, but only because journalists and other things, you know, and actual things are coming out with safety issues and whatnot that lead to it. So I think there is a certain level of self-accountability that will lead to ultimate standardization. That was the original question.
Well, right, we had more time, but we actually don't. So it's time to wrap it up. I want to thank Tanis for joining me. Nathan, thanks for joining me in person.
Thank you guys.
Thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our live show at the ECC Future Leaders Wednesday session. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is the Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.